Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guests are Malcolm and Simone Collins, and we'll be talking about their book, The Pragmatist's Guide to Life, a guide to creating your own answers to life's biggest questions. If you're looking for a light read that will make you feel good about yourself, this isn't the book for you. If you want to take the time to think hard, take full ownership of the person that you have allowed yourself to become, and permanently transform yourself into the best iteration of that person, then you have found your book. This book was created as the work of a nonprofit institution dedicated to helping people think through the big questions in life without leading them to a specific answer. All proceeds from the sale of the book go to the nonprofit and not the authors. For more information, you can visit the website pragmatist.guide. And I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, I'd like to welcome Malcolm and Simone to the show. Good day, folks.
Good day to you as well. It is so wonderful to be chatting with you.
Hi.
Hi, great. Well, I'm really looking forward to chatting about this. I've been known to be rather pragmatic myself at times, but I like the kind of the approach that you've taken. So, if you wouldn't mind, would you share with the listeners what was the genesis or the inspiration for this particular book?
Gosh, it goes back to 2012, when I turned 24 years old and decided that year I needed to fall in love and have my heart broken, having never dated anyone before or, you know, had sex or anything. And I went on this rather systematic campaign, which included a scoring system to determine if someone was worth a second date and a points-based system to encourage me to be competitive with my colleagues, where we had points for certain things you did on dates to try to get me out there and doing more dates. I met Malcolm in the midst of this strange year, and he was just so different from every other person that I'd gone on a first date with, because while I couldn't really get much of anything in terms of purpose, even from the date of the people that I went on a date with, I mean, even though it was kind of obvious what they wanted and why they were there, Malcolm sat me across from him at our first date, and he said, "Well, I'm not really looking to date right now. I'm looking to find a wife, and I expect to find her this fall at Stanford, where there's the biggest pool of pre-vetted candidates." And I was just floored to hear someone say that on a first date, and then proceed to tell me his entire life plan, his values, how he came to develop those values, how he came to develop his life plan. And then he turned to me and said, "Okay, so what about you?" And I was stumped, and I started saying a lot of, you know, silly things like, "Well, I wanted to be happy, and I wanted to help other people, and I wanted to achieve some level of spiritual attainment," which was all true. I mean, every year I would take different, you know, religious pilgrimage trips to Vatican City or some remote pilgrimage island in Japan to try to understand better what everything means. And even though I did that, even though I gave a huge portion of my income every year to charity, I realized at that moment when he actually asked me to explain why I valued what I valued and why I did what I did, just how not only not lasting and fleeting all those actions were, but also just how superficial they were. And Malcolm then, after I sort of came back to him and I said, "Well, crap, you know, this is not actually what I believe, and it feels empty to me. How do I figure this out?" He helped me for myself, just as we try to advocate with our book and guide with our book, how to develop my own answers to life's biggest questions. And it had a transformative effect on my life. It was insane. And after seeing the impact that it had on me, given where we are 6 years later now, we decided about 3 or 4 years ago that we should try to turn this process into a book. And that's what led the book to become a thing.
Well, the second half of the book that you're sort of leaving out here, which was also part of your own process,
yeah,
which is she came to me and she said, okay, I know what I want for my life now. I know what I need to do. And I said, well, I mean, look at you. How are you going to do it being the person you are now? You know, from her outfit to the way she talked to her job title. And I was like, so who do you think?
Well, I came to him with my objective function, essentially, which is how we describe basically your purpose in life in the book. And he looked at me and he sort of gestured vaguely at me and said, so you expect to achieve them like that? And for a little bit of context, I was very much the classic Silicon Valley startup manic pixie dream girl. I wore vintage rayon taffeta dresses one day, Harajuku street fashion the other day, red fishnet stockings, mini skirts, all of that. I dressed sort of in costume because people, you know, gave me a lot of positive reinforcement when I walked around dressed like a cartoon character. And Malcolm helped me realize pretty quickly that I, given the objective function that I had, given the things I actually wanted to achieve with my life, once I gave myself some time to think about it, I wasn't going to achieve it at all doing what we did. So essentially we created a character sheet for the kind of person that would achieve my goals, all the way down to, you know, what did she wear? What did she drink? How did she talk? How did she move? And we transformed me into that person. And that is what we describe in the second half of the book. So the first half is, okay, how do you establish your values, your purpose in life, how you believe what you believe, your philosophies on how you're going to achieve what you achieve. And then the rest of the book is about, okay, well, how do you optimize yourself to do all those things? How do you make your internal self-identity, your external identity, something that executes perfectly on your values and goals?
Yeah. So, Malcolm, it sounds like, you know, prior to your meeting that this is something that you've given a lot of thought to, if you're able to kind of recite basically your objective function, values, all of that kind of thing. So when was it that you kind of honed yourself into that knowledge?
I mean, my realization moment is such a mundane story that I don't often tell it, which is I was in middle school. I had a choice to go hang out with friends or study for a test. And I said, oh, what of these two things do I do? And then I started thinking, I was like, well, if I study for the test, I might be able to get more aggregate happiness in the future. Even if I go out with friends now, I could get happiness. So how do I value, you know, the probability of happiness in the future versus happiness right now? But I would get social interactions with friends, and that could help me in this way. And then I started focusing on, okay, so, I mean, is it about distributing happiness throughout my life? And I was like, well, why do I really care about happiness? You know, I don't see any reason to believe that happiness is anything uniquely special. I mean, it's just an emotion that my body outputs that I like because, you know, it's typically doing things that, you know, give me pleasure or when I achieve something of substantive success, which makes sense that you're, you know, you'd be rewarded with happiness for that stuff. And I really went into this existential crisis, which was like, and I ended up not studying for the test or going out with friends, where I was like, I need some set of heuristics for making day-to-day decisions that are based on something that I believe is, you know, fundamentally true about the world. And I tried and I worked really hard. And one thing that we've always focused on was this is when I went to look for answers, I found that everybody was selling whatever they believed. You know, I could go to, you know, my local pastor, but, you know, he knows what he believes and he's going to guide me down that route because it's what he believes. You know, I could go to a philosophy professor and they're going to be like, okay, well, here are some various philosophers and you could choose amongst them.
It's like people say, If you ask for advice from anyone, you're going to get advice that would put you where they are now.
Yes.
And that really bothers us because that's not optimal. That's not what everyone wants.
And so what I then said and what we focused on was this, was trying to create advice for people that didn't lead them down a specific path, didn't assume something was true, and makes a lot of questions about things in our society that we just think are obviously true and obviously of value, you know? And so we really help people ask those questions that maybe they didn't think to ask. Like, for example, why specifically does equality have value? The question we start the book with is, why is genocide wrong? And that sort of is what the book is about, is getting you to think through and question all of these things that everyone all around you has always told you were true. Because so often throughout history, something that most people in a society believed turned out to be, well, at least from our perspective, pretty morally reprehensible. And it's very hard to tell when you're living in a society what those things are going to be in the future, and even if the future societies are going to be right in their judgment of those things.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's great that you take people outside the programming and really cause them to think about, you know, their particular set of beliefs and why. So, again, like you say, a lot of people don't necessarily do that. I mean, it's you kind of are raised in a particular way. You have your beliefs. Your beliefs are generated by, you know, those who you're surrounded with, and you know, generally, I mean, you can, you know, make adjustments a little bit here and there, but quite often, you know, we don't go back to basics, you know, is exactly why. So one of the things, when you talked about the objective function, you know, like define your objective function, and you indicated that kind of is synonymous with purpose, a purpose. Why objective, first of all, you know, because in Malcolm, you know, when I heard you talk about your that mundane decision, you know, school, you know, test or happiness, you know, I mean, it seems that we are programmed to strive for happiness as much as possible. So why the objective, and is the emotional component still a part of the process?
Absolutely. So I'll get to the emotional component right after talking about this. But so the question is why we use the word objective function. And it's sort of to break the society's sort of stereotypes around what a purpose of someone is. So, for example, somebody who is a true nihilist could still have an objective function. They still have some set of heuristics they're using when they make a decision. And an objective function in math is an equation that's meant to maximize a certain output. It's the output you're trying to maximize. And so the reason why we use sort of a math term for this is, let's just give an example, right? Because a person's objective function is very rarely one thing. It's usually a weighted combination of things that they're trying to maximize with their life. So a person might say, I value my own happiness, 2x, twice as much as I value the happiness of other people, but I value both. Now, by knowing those two things, you can say, okay, if I gave this money to another person and it would increase their happiness more than it would increase my own happiness, but not two times it would increase my own happiness, then I would keep that money.
Okay.
And then for the second more emotional point is, we really focus on emotions in the later parts of the book. When we talk about rebuilding yourself, you know, I used to be a neuroscientist. And one thing that I've always really focused on is specifically, what are the pathways that cause us to feel emotions? Can those pathways be manipulated? And can we change the type of person we am? We are. So suppose, somebody, you know, gets angry and starts yelling at somebody. And then they leave and they go, look, I can't help it. That's just who I am. The reality is that they can help it. They can create themselves into somebody who wouldn't have that emotional impulse and who wouldn't undertake that action. And we think that people need to take more ownership of who they've allowed themselves to become and try to become people who can maximize the things they believe have value in the world.
Okay. So now, and I understand the, the neural aspect of emotion. So there's often talk about neuroplasticity, the ability to create new connections. Is that kind of what you're talking about as far as changing the reactions to situations?
I don't really, I mean, neuroplasticity is a concept where, you know, you can change the way parts of your brain sort of function. But typically it's more, it doesn't apply here. It's close, but it doesn't really apply in this context, just based off of the model we have for how emotions are processed. We don't think it's something as complex as a neuroplasticity sort of an issue. What we think is, which, you know, is more comes into play when, you know, you get a part of your brain damaged when you're really young and then the brain grows back, or you allow your brain to change at certain points in your life. But not to get into that, the model we believe, like the way we believe humans process emotions and we've sort of experimented with, is a lot simpler than that. Essentially, a person has these loops we run when we're creating theories of mind for other people. So when you have an argument with someone in your head, you've created a little, you know, sort of fake virtual person in your head that you're arguing with. And this person has their own proclivities, their own beliefs, their own everything like that. And as a side note, the way I came up with this is I used to work in schizophrenia, and my hypothesis is what's happening in many types of schizophrenia is the threshold for those sort of voices and other personalities we create in our head is lowered, and so they appear without direct stimulation. But anyway, these models that we create about other people, we actually have them for ourselves as well. We have a little model that we've created in our head that sort of feels a certain way about things, that reacts a certain way to things. And when we get some environmental stimuli, we tell a story about that stimuli, and then we check that story against this little virtual person we have in our head that decides what emotion to output. The check against them, the person doesn't decide. You're just like, oh, this is the type of person who gets angry when, you know, a waiter accidentally spills salt all over their food or something. But that little person in your head, that little model, that template that you're checking against is alterable, but only under specific circumstances.
Okay. What kind of circumstances would make that model alterable?
You see this a lot in anything from addiction treatment programs to government intervention programs. So you may be familiar with the practice of, you know, getting someone to quit smoking by moving them to another country for a month or so. Or many government programs that are trying to present interventions to different types of people at different stages of life have come to learn that they need to get people as they have a first-time life-changing event, like your first child. And what it comes down to is that when you are in a period of flux and you are changing your own identity because you've moved to a new city or you've graduated from high school or you've just lost a spouse or something else that really fundamentally changes your surroundings and basically the stage on which the play of your life is being played out, that's when you can actually go in and start altering your self-image. The problem of trying to do that without changing the costumes of your play, the settings, the co-stars, is that they just push you right back into that old model that you had.
Because that's the model that interacted with them and fit sort of a slot within that social group. You know, the study that I love most around this is, I don't remember the exact amount, but it was when heroin addicts went back from Vietnam. It was something like they had like a 80 or 90% recovery rate upon returning, just because their environment changed that much that even something as deeply seated as an addiction to heroin was able to be lost because of that drastic shift of environment. They were able to rewrite who they were to such an extent. And I would say that I actually don't think that that's exactly a mental model thing. That's an addiction pathway. But they were able to build mental models that were able to beat that addiction pathway at a very high rate.
Okay. So that makes sense, you know, being able to shift, you know, the environment and the interactions and because basically what you're doing is you're basically creating a new model. I mean, you know, all of the influences in the old model are kind of stripped away, then forcing you basically to change.
Correct.
Okay. Now, Simone, when you mentioned that you and Malcolm, you were kind of going through the identification of what it was you, Simone, wanted to do, and you had the character, I forgot what the term you used, but, you know, the character needed.
Character sheet.
Yeah. Did that process feel true to you? You know, I mean, in the sense that, you know, that you weren't creating something that was like an image to project rather than an internal accurate picture of who you wanted it to be.
Yeah, actually, I felt like for the first time ever, I was actually being true to myself. And then the way we describe it in the book is you kind of live your life like a sticky ball rolling down the street, kind of picking up everything that's around it. And you could choose to clean off the sticky ball and put on whatever you want. But most people don't ever get to that point. And for me, it was incredibly empowering to say, here are my core values. Here's what I want to achieve with my life. And here's who I want to be. And ultimately, I became more someone that I feel comfortable being, more someone that I've always wished I could be than I could have ever imagined.
I think another way to think about this is a person, the you that was created by, you know, serendipitous events in your life, random things that you were, you know, exposed to or had inflicted upon you, is that version more who you are than a version that you consciously chose to create? We would argue that the version of you that you consciously choose to create that wasn't created by a few random rolls of the dice and random events inflicted upon you is a truer version of you than that other version of you.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, and you know that was I just wanted to be clear that it was more of the process was more clarifying than it was. Outward projection, trying to present something that wasn't true. So, I understand that is, that it would have been a very cathartic, I guess, kind of process in being able to kind of get a clearer sense of who you are, Simone. Now, either one of you, in the book, you talk a little bit about religious belief systems, hard religious beliefs, soft religious belief systems, and I just also wanted to make clear that your book, like you said in the beginning, you basically ask the questions and you don't provide the answers because you allow the people to, get the answers themselves. So, I mean, it's not directed in a particular way. But how do religious belief systems fit into this particular pragmatic process?
I would argue they fit in really, really well. Like I said earlier, like in my previous life, I spent a lot of time getting to know as many religions as I could, Shinto, Catholicism, Mormons I love. And I was drawn to people of great faith who were passionate about their religion and really informed about it. And I think to a great extent, they are models for us as the perfect pragmatists because they have a very clear objective function. They've thought, they've soul searched, they've researched constantly why they've come to that conclusion, why they've chosen to have faith. And they have a very clear set of ideologies and standards of evidence that they use to help them decide what's true, what's not, what they should do, what they should not do. We have immense, immense respect.
Yeah, and we may disagree with their individual belief systems and something like that, but what we care more about is showing your work.
Yeah.
And we feel that within, many religious traditions, you have people who have enormously shown their worth. So an example of work as an example of how this might play out in the guide, right? You mentioned how we define soft religious belief system, which is a religious belief system where you say, basically, I believe this religion, like Christianity, or something like that, except for all of these parts. All of these parts in the text, I just don't believe. And typically people make this choice because, you know, these parts aren't really PC within modern society or something like that. And what we challenge people who have those sort of belief systems to do is to think through, okay, where does your understanding, and honestly do this, don't just say, oh, my pastor says this isn't something I actually need to worry about. Actually, read your religious text and say, my beliefs differ from the dogma in these religious texts in this, this, and this way. And I think it's okay to you know, provide the religious text with this moral update or whatever, because these three things carry this common characteristic, which, you know, for some reason wasn't properly recorded in the original religious text or needs to be changed over time.
Yeah, okay. I like that perspective, you know, because, like you say, you know, proof is in the work. You know, because one of the things that I would see that could be difficult is that in many religions, some of the dogma sometimes, you know, it's this way because it is this way, you know, and does not allow for free thinking or deviation from, you know, that particular belief. But like what you say, you know, that the idea of soft religious belief systems, you know, opens the door to really identifying one's own belief systems and what resonates, you know, what part of a religious belief system resonates with them and what doesn't.
Yeah.
But we would give the big caveat that what's unacceptable, or at least by our system, and what we don't think will lead to a satisfying or meaningful life, is just choosing to believe whatever makes you feel comfortable.
And so many people with religious belief systems are like that. It's like, this is the convenient religion for me to believe because of the community I happen to live in, or the way I want to see myself. You know, I want to see myself as like ultra spiritual and powerful and sort of like mysterious. So I might choose some like Eastern religion that I really don't know that much about and then build my identity around that, instead of, you know, actually researching these religions, and not in a, you know, hippie sort of way, but in a, you know, okay, if I'm doing it in a hippie sort of way, why am I okay with changing the doctrine of this belief system to make it easier to follow it?
Yeah, I can understand that, but wouldn't it be true to the nature of the process to that if you studied, you know, or you there is something about a particular belief system that just doesn't seem right to you, you know, and you look into it, you read about it, the way that it's presented, the way that it's communicated through the, you know, the religious authorities for that particular religion, and it still does not resonate with you, then it seems that, you know, that's being true to your nature, and that you're doing it for the right purpose. You're doing it because inside you, it just does not resonate. Not that it's easy or not. I mean, you know, I mean, this not including your social environment, you know, your family, all of the other variables. But within your nature, it just does not, you know, feel at heart level to be right.
So one thing we talk about in the book is standards of evidence, and this really comes down to the idea of standards of evidence. And you get to choose the types of evidence that you believe trump other types of evidence. So you may choose, say, whether something feels right or doesn't feel right is a higher standard of evidence than, you know, a specific religious dogma, or maybe a higher standard of evidence than, you know, scientific consensus on a particular topic. And a way that we often help people think through this, because it is important, what we care about, if you say, well, it doesn't feel right to me, therefore I don't choose to believe it, we then say, okay, so logically, why do you view whether something feels right or doesn't feel right as being such a great indicator of whether or not it is true? And we say it's perfectly fine to have it be your top indicator, right? Like, as with everything else, we argue against it and we argue for it. But it's important to ask yourself those questions and really sort of line up the indicators you use to change your deeply held beliefs. And the thought experiment we use is people who say, okay, you either believe in ghosts or don't believe in ghosts, right? What type of evidence would you need to see to change your mind on this? So suppose we're talking to somebody who doesn't believe in ghosts. I'm like, suppose a scientific paper came out and said that ghosts are real. Would you change your belief then? Suppose you saw ghosts. Would you change your belief, or would you say, oh, I must just have schizophrenia? Suppose like a bunch of newspapers started printing articles about how ghosts were everywhere. Would that change your beliefs on the subject? And the reason why it's so important to know the types of evidence that we're willing to use to update deeply held beliefs for us is because when you don't clearly define the types of evidence that you use, it's very easy to follow the inclination that all humans have, which is to not update their beliefs when presented with new evidence, to not change what they think when presented with a logical contradiction. And so they switch up their standards of evidence. You know, if believing science first allows them to believe one thing, okay, they'll believe it in that case. But if believing your gut feeling most allows them to believe another thing, okay, they'll believe it in that case, as long as it means they don't have to update what they think about the world. And that's the thing that we would criticize. But we don't say, you have to think about the world this way or this way. It's more just understand the sources of evidence that you're using when you're developing your opinions about things.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, we're about halfway through the show, Simone and Malcolm, and I want to take just a quick 90-second break, and I do want to invite listeners that if you have any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, you can feel free to type in your question there. And then when we come back from the break, I want to kind of move in. Step two in your book, you talk about an ideological tree. And I'd like to kind of get a little bit understanding of what that is, and so that the readers can understand exactly what you are talking about there, okay? So we'll be back in about 90 seconds.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today, my very special guests are Malcolm and Simone Collins, and we're talking about the book, The Pragmatist's Guide to Life, a guide to creating your own answers to life's biggest questions. And again, you can find out more by visiting the website, which is pragmatist.guide. And I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back. Malcolm and Simone?
Hello.
Great. Okay. So Step two in the book, and you kind of got it broken down into the four different steps, but step two, you talk about an ideological tree. So can you kind of explain what that is and how it fits into the system that you describe?
So when we talk about step one is understanding specifically what you want to maximize with your life or the various weighted things you want to maximize with your life. Your ideological tree is a set of hypotheses you have about how the world works that are useful in maximizing these things. And it's a tree because it branches. So suppose you may think that democracy is the best form of government, and then subordinate to that belief would be the Republican Party is the best way to maximize my objective function within a democratic system. And then subordinate to that, you might have a particular political candidate. And the reason why we say it's important to sort of visualize this as a tree is I often find that people will change sort of these lower rungs on the tree or never challenge the lower rungs on the tree. And it's the lowest rungs on our ideological trees that we need to focus most on, because if we're wrong about those hypotheses about how the world works, then everything else, so much of what we do in life will be wrong or counterproductive in terms of achieving our objective functions. You know, if you are wrong about the path you need to take to achieve spiritual enlightenment, and that is your part of your objective function, you know, expanding your consciousness, you're not going to achieve it because you're wrong about the path that you're on and the ideas you have about that path. And when you focus on the sort of ideological tree, as we call it, it's important to focus on how might I be wrong, and to look for areas where you might be wrong.
Okay. Before we go further, wrong as in the sense that it is not.
No.
Well, wait a second. I think that what you're talking about is that it's in a sense that it is not supporting your what you feel your objective function should be or is.
Right. So here would be an example, right? You decide that your objective function is primarily based around sort of distributing maximum happiness throughout a population. And you decide the best tool for doing this, just to stay within the politics side, is communism. Now, you could be objectively wrong about this belief. It could be that if communism was implemented in exactly the way you would want it implemented within this society, you would actually not maximize the happiness of the people within that society when contrasted with the other options you might choose. And it is that potentiality for being wrong about something that means that you should focus on those things and you should think to yourself, okay, is this right? Is this wrong? What evidence would I need to overturn these deeply held beliefs? And then the more important question is, have I looked for that evidence? And keep in mind that we're very open to what evidence you think is better than other evidence. You know, it could be, do I have a gut feeling that this is wrong? Have I really searched my gut feelings to determine this is wrong or this is wrong? Because a lot of people really never take time to think about or question the beliefs that are lowest on their ideological tree.
Yes, and I agree with that. You know, and many times people will just go along, you know, for lack of a better phrase, you know, with, you know, what a particular ideology or you know, belief system is, just because it is, you know, rather than doing the questioning whether or not. So it seems that, you know, when it comes time for, you know, this particular tree, ideology, that it really is, the idea of it is to support your ultimate objective, you know.
Right.
And whether or not some of the limbs or the branches that kind of come off that, you know, that tree, whether or not they are helping you achieve that or whether they are a detriment to that achievement.
Absolutely. Yes, perfectly said.
Okay. So now, keeping in the tree metaphor, pruning branches and cutting loose some of those branches. That is something that in this particular process you feel that people really need to do, to do some pruning and allow for some fresh new growth.
Yes, we are vehemently for that. And one of the tricks that we have for helping you know if you should prune a branch is if something offends you. So if you see someone do something or come across something that makes you palpably offended, you know, you feel emotional about it, it suggests that both that thing disagrees with your ideological tree, with your hypotheses about the way the world works. But it also threatens you, either your perception of the world or your perception of yourself. And that's exciting to us because it means that we could be wrong, and it means that we could have a better solution to our objective function out there that we don't know about now. So we encourage people to really lean in when something offends them and threatens them, because it may enable them to find better information.
Yeah, we love to use that as our little flag. You know, it's like there's a little pin here. My brain just put a pin in this idea or this argument against something that's important to me because I felt offense when somebody mentioned it. And you don't typically feel offense if something isn't threatening to you. If something isn't threatening to you and somebody says it, it you see it as silly. You know, you're like, that's ridiculous and, you know, whatever, but it doesn't offend you. But when something offends you, it means that you see it as a real threat to you. And it's important to remember that there's sort of two categories of offense here. There's a category of offense, which means, you know, your worldview is wrong or might be wrong. But then there's the other category of offense, which is sort of your self-perception of yourself. Like, I might see myself as a smart person, and if somebody says you're not a smart person, then I would be offended by that, especially if I'm insecure about whether or not I actually believe I'm a smart person.
Yeah. So with that particular stimulus or that particular reaction to an event or circumstances, the offense, feeling offended, if one were to take your approach of looking at the looking deeper as to, you know, what it is, why is it that I'm offended by this, rather than being defensive. I mean, it seems to be a much more creative and healthy way to deal with that type of emotion.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, and obviously when it's something personal, you know, if it's you take personal offense, you know, I think that's, you know, that's, like you said, Malcolm, you know, possibly there's a little bit of, you know, insecurity regarding that particular topic, it seems that it would be a great way to bolster confidence, but also to recognize that, you know, someone else offending you personally, it just provides the opportunity for you to get stronger and really not take it personally. I mean, you know, I know people who just grasp on to personal offense, you know, and mm-hmm. kind of run with it and get all either defensive or combative, you know, and there's a point when others' view of you. Let me put it this way: in your book, you talk about kind of how to present oneself to others, or how you want others to view you. Mm-hmm. There, I can understand the importance of others. Like, if you want to promote a confident, you know, either enlightened or however you want to promote yourself in a positive manner, that if someone does not receive that and they come back with something that is objectionable, I mean, there's a point where you, let me put it this way, is there a point where you balance you know, kind of what you're projecting, what you want to project, and then recognizing that if somehow you don't get back, you don't get that recognition of what you're promoting, you know, I mean, the thing is that where is it that we really give credence or weight to what others think about us versus what we think of ourselves?
I think a lot of that comes down to your standard of evidence. So when someone feels offended by someone, we encourage them to stop and think about why they think they're offended, what information this person has presented that scares us, and then systematically think through, okay, if I am wrong, what standard of evidence would I use to determine whether or not I am wrong? And then where can I find that information if it exists? And then seek it out. So we're trying to present people with a systematic way of just figuring it out for themselves. And imagine a world in which instead of getting belligerent or violent or angry or otherwise disruptive towards the world, if people just did that process, just tried to learn for themselves what something actually meant.
And why exactly they're feeling a specific emotional state.
The world would be so much more peaceful and productive.
And to pull apart sort of two other things you said there, one was you were saying, well, you know, the way you want other people to see you and the way you want to see yourself. We would argue, you know, you don't choose the way you want to see yourself, you know, to stroke your own ego or something like that. You know, you choose, oh, happiness is the thing, my own happiness is the thing that matters most to me in life. How can I create an internal model that is easily made happy? And then you can much more easily maximize the amount of positive emotions you're feeling. Or a sense of fulfillment from achieving major goals is the thing that matters to me most. How can I create an internal model where I can maximize that sensation? And then you might say when you start thinking about this, well, it's not actually the sensation that I want. It's the achievement of the goals I want, and I want the goals to actually be lofty, so I don't want that model of myself to have goals that are too easy or too quick to achieve. And I think that you, through choosing who you want to be and how you want to see yourself, you can modulate how you interact with the world when you're operating on autopilot, which most of us are doing most of the time. You know, we have very few moments of lucidity in our lives where we really think, huh, okay, why this, why this? And you know, different people have different amounts of moments of lucidity, but I would say that only
right.
Very, very few people are normally lucid. You know, normally we're just reacting based on how we see ourselves.
Right. So, see, I'm trying to... You know, I understand what you were saying. I'm trying to get a handle on the internal sense. I mean, if I go through the process and I have a pretty clear understanding of who I am and what I project, what I want to project, what my you know. Objective function, you know, is going to be what I wanted to, you know, what it is for me, and I, you know, project that I do everything, you know, within myself, creating that model of, you know, the character, all of the components of self to optimize that to achieve that objective. Then if I get something contrary to that, you know, if feedback comes back from others, you know, that what they see or hear or the basically that contradicts my belief
yes,
of what I'm doing.
Yes, you will have a negative emotional reaction.
Right. So... And so the point, and I guess the point is that if is it then critical, or is the basic aspect to have that strong internal model, and that if you get contrary feedback, then it's, I mean, you can look at it objectively, and maybe it might, you know, change your perspective. It might be one of those, you know, standards or, you know, a bit of evidence, you know, that maybe you hadn't considered before, and you may alter it. But if it does not you know, what they're presenting does not kind of fit into what you've already decided, even if it's, you know, after going through some critical thought, then it's kind of like you disregard that. I mean, so see, my what I'm juggling with this particular model is that you know, I can understand, you know, creating and achieving that objective, but in today's world, you know, we get, no matter where you are, who you are, you're going to get, you know, contrary feedback. So what do you do with contrary feedback? Is it, again, like I said, do you just examine the evidence and then if it's appropriate, adjust, or if it's not, just disregard?
I think where you might be getting tripped up here, or I don't really know if this is exactly what we wanted to convey, and clearly we aren't maybe articulating ourselves well here. And I think that the key, you know, sort of differentiation between what you're used to hearing with these sorts of systems and what we're saying is, we do not bias towards wanting to experience positive emotions. You build the model that you want to build of yourself that is going to react in a way, positive or negative, that's going to move you towards your goals. You know, when you, an example of this, you see a guy, you know, beating a woman on the street, right? And your internal model of yourself is somebody who gets angry when you see that and wants to do something to stop it. You have used this internal model to create a negative emotional set, which then causes you to take action in that instance. Now, suppose you fail in that instance, and your internal model isn't somebody who would fail at preventing that sort of thing from happening, and so you get upset with yourself, and you look down on yourself. You could say, oh, well, those are all negative emotions, therefore, you know, you should just make sure you don't feel them. But we would argue, if through feeling those emotions, you are able to increase the probability that next time you enter a situation like this, you're able to handle it in a way that does the type of thing the person you want to see yourself would do, then allow yourself to feel those negative emotions, know why you're feeling those negative emotions, and use them as motivation to reflect on how you can be successful next time. And we do think that it is possible to build mental models that are largely almost always have, but very few people want them, because for a mental model to basically always make you happy, it has to be a mental model that doesn't care you fail, and because we're going to fail no matter what in life, you know, at certain things, there's always a funny action you undertake. And so the only way to be happy all the time is to not care about failure, and a lot of people, when they, you know, come to that realization, say, oh, I guess I don't want to be happy all the time because I do want to care when I fail because there are things I want to achieve.
Yeah. Okay. I can understand that. Now, guys, we're getting down toward the end of the show. So one of the things, you know, we've kind of identified several of the steps in your book. The fourth step kind of revolves around defining one's public character. Can you talk a little bit about that? And is this something that would be something different from your private character? You know
absolutely.
So, a
core mistake that a lot of people make. I would say there's sort of two that I want to get to here. The first is my public character should be my private character, because that's the most honest version of myself. You know, my public character should be as close to my internal model as possible. That's what people think. And we would argue that sort of like, you know, a word processing developer just printing the code for the software on the box. And if word processing developers did that, all of the boxes would look basically the same and really boring. And then you have the one box, which is like big infographics. This is how we're different from other word processing software. You know, and this is, you know, this feature, and here is independent verification of this. And that's going to grab the sort of world's attention much more than just putting the code on the box that makes everybody sort of look the same.
So in that final section of the Pragmatist Guide to Life, we walk people through the process of considering how, as humans, you can stand out from the rest of the crowd and actually be, like Malcolm described, a product that people want to buy. And mm-hmm. and you describe how you really want to be a caricature of your true self, you know, so you're still representing who you are, but in much simpler, more vibrant and colorful terms. We also talk about the importance of not just having good things that you telegraph to the world, but also bad things about yourself, so that you are predictably good and bad, and people feel like they can trust you and understand you and predict you, which makes you a much more alluring figure.
Just to come back to the original point, you know, one thing that makes it really hard for people to get over this is they're like, I just want people to see the real me. And the question I would ask is, if somebody talked to you for like 4 hours yesterday, would they know the real you? Like, how close would they come to knowing the real you? And then I would ask them, over the past month, or maybe even 6 months, how many people in the world have taken the time to talk to you for four or 5 hours?
Well, and about you. Too.
And about you specifically. And the answer is probably a couple, maybe. The vast majority of people you interact with in the world only see you for 10 or 30 minutes and don't really spend that much time thinking about you.
And those are the people you need to get to do things.
Yes. So in that point, another thing that people will say is, I don't care what other people think of me. And that's a self-model you can build. You can build a self-model that doesn't care what other people think of you. But it's typically a pretty self-destructive self-model for achieving really any objective function. You know, even unless you like want to go to the woods and meditate and expand your consciousness, you're going to be interacting with other people. And whether
right.
those people like you and want to help you or don't like you and don't want to help you matters a lot in terms of your ability to achieve the change in the world you want to see or achieve the lifestyle you want to live.
Yeah, I agree. Well, gosh, our hour has flown by, and we're down to the very end. So what would you hope that people are going to take away from reading The Pragmatist's Guide to Life?
It's to think intentionally, to not assume that something is true or probably right just because everyone around you says it.
Well, more importantly, I would say take responsibility for your identity,
yes.
your beliefs, and your actions. You don't have to believe or do or be anything that you don't stand for.
I love that so much better.
That's good. Well, listen, I really appreciate speaking with you both. It's been a fascinating hour and discussion. And, you know, it's just a real unique perspective and process. And I think that people would do well to go through the process and get more clarity in their life. And so I really want to thank you for spending your time and talking with me today.
We really appreciate that, and this has been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you. Again, everyone, today my very special guests have been...
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.